let's start on the Cape, where some communities actually want to speed up the state's reopening process. One of those communities is Yarmouth, whose Board of Selectmen recently passed a resolution allowing businesses to conduct normal operations, quote, without fear of local repercussions. Here to discuss with us is Dan Knapik, Yarmouth's town administrator. Dan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
So let me start by asking you about this resolution. Specifically, what does it do?
Well, so there was a lot of discussion. It's a 3-2 motion, and the majority is wanted to send the sentiment to Boston that we need to speed up reopening. We only have about an 8 to 10 week window to make revenue for these small businesses. These are family-owned operations, and the selectmen felt frustrated that more wasn't going on in that arena, and we felt that these are the governor's orders, and perhaps the governor should then be responsible for enforcing those. And I think that was the general sentiment to discuss about that they didn't want to send the wrong message to people in that there isn't potentially a ramification from a state agency to enforce the order. And they also recognize that the Board of Health in town has its own obligation to protect the public's health, and they would also be subject to enforcement by the Board of Health. So it was more a matter of a motion crafted, I think, out of the need to get something moving up in Boston. And in Barnstable County, and I think the sentiment of the majority was that we shouldn't be treated like Boston.
Right. We're having a little bit of trouble with the audio, obviously, on a cell phone, but those are some of the challenges we face in the age of COVID. Have you seen actual businesses that the state has not given the green light to, like bowling alleys or bars or something of that nature? Are any of those businesses actually opening without state approval?
I'm not aware of any, and I would add indoor pools. Yarmouth has the largest concentration of indoor pools on the Cape. There's 33 of them. So in resorts and hotels with the indoor pools, those owners are very frustrated that they can't open those up. And they've told us that they think they can do that safely.
So I'm curious how this works now. You said that the local Board of Health has to act on behalf of the state. So if someone files a complaint with the local Board of Health, say there is a bar that decides to open despite the fact that the state has not given that green light, will that complaint be taken to state authorities? What is the procedure after this resolution?
Well, so when reopening began, the state issued directives to local enforcement entities about how that should go. And it's essentially a three-tiered approach. One is on the first visit, it should be an educational event, like a verbal warning, if you will. And then if you get a second one on that facility, that should be escalated to a written warning. And then the third one is the one in which a local municipality could generate a fine structure. So right now, when we get a complaint, the staff investigates it. We have a dialogue with the owner. We find out what the details are. And in the instances in which it might have been a premature opening, we issue them the verbal warning. And they've been good about understanding, but they wanted somebody to vent their frustration to.
So if there was a business that opens without getting the approval, would the town issue a fine? I'm assuming you haven't issued any fines as of now.
No, we have not issued any fines. And like I said, I think when we do visit those businesses that have done a bit of a jump start, they have listened to what the instructions are from the town, and they've conducted themselves going forward with the understanding that there could be penalties associated with that, and we haven't had any further follow-up problems. But we do make sure they know that the state is also able to come in, and not only the state police or the state health department, but the Alcoholic Beverage Control Commission and also the State Department of Labor could also all come in on these complaints, because those complaints often go to those state agencies from the public as well.
I'm curious if you worry at all that this sends mixed messages to folks who are trying to figure out how to navigate life during a pandemic. You have orders to wear face masks when you can't socially distance coming from the governor. But then if Yarmouth is saying if you feel you can open safely, go ahead and open. Do you worry that that downplays the seriousness of the situation?
Well, so interestingly, last night's conversation with the board came a week after the first motion had passed, and there was a time in which we received dozens and dozens of emails, and the majority of which were critical of that decision. And in that time, I think it became apparent that perhaps the motion, as it was intended, did not get received, or it was received by some parts of the public, like it was a carte blanche to open up and you didn't need any controls. And, you know, that was not at all the intent of the board. It was more a matter of, you know, we've got a critical situation here. And I try to tell people the board for months had been grappling with cutting the budget and reducing local receipts by $6 million. And so when you drove up and down the town streets and all the Cape towns from March till June, you know, all the hotels, the motels, the restaurants were empty. And, you know, when you think about what the receipts are going to look like when the books close, it's devastating to our towns. And so I think the selectmen in that background were very frustrated at the progress of opening things, because the owners here, all families, there's no real chain entities once you get to our region of the Cape and beyond, they're in fear of losing their businesses and their livelihood. So I think to a large point, the board made mention that, you know, people have got the information now about wearing masks and social distancing. And certainly if you don't want to be part of the public engagement activities, then you can stay at home. But businesses need to do what businesses need to do. And I think it's a bit of a complicated message in that it can be heard in different ways. But certainly the board didn't intend people to just blatantly break the law, if you will.
Yeah, Dan, I totally hear you on the economic concerns and understand there's real people with livelihoods at stake here. It is interesting that so much of your economy is based in tourism. I know Bruce Murphy, the Yarmouth Health Department director, told Cape Cod Times that they're going to enforce the governor's reopening plan. He said, quote, "Everybody is coming down to the Cape and you want to keep them safe." How do you think about that as a community? I know you have low infection rates right now, but as a community based on tourism, how are you thinking about safety as we head into the summer months?
Well, so I had the pleasure of traveling off Cape on Friday night, and what I would tell you is driving off Cape and seeing what was coming on Cape, you would never know we were in the middle of a worldwide pandemic. The traffic backup was ungodly. And that being said, I think there's, you know, amongst the full-time residents in the Cape towns, there's a deep concern. There's a fear about the onslaught of visitors. And I think many of the proprietors of businesses that cater to those visitors feel confident that they have measures in place that will mitigate any problems associated with transmission. That being said, as a town and as a government, we're kind of caught in between. And, you know, the beaches are already being overcrowded. And I had some calls over the weekend at the field about that. And, you know, we just know that as the, you know, we got the 4th of July coming up, that's a huge week here. There's probably going to be not a facility on the Cape that doesn't push the envelope as it relates to, you know, what are the good norms today for mask wearing and social distancing. So it's going to be a real challenge to protect those folks that, that just don't want to comply necessarily, or those business establishments that aren't assisting us in compliance. So there's a certain amount of trepidation, I think, amongst the town leadership.
All right. Well, best of luck to you. Stay safe. Really appreciate you joining us today. That's Yarmouth Town Administrator Dan Knapik. Dan, thanks for the time.
Absolutely, Chris. Take care now.
Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins joined Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, Suffolk County Sheriff Stephen Tompkins, and other local leaders earlier today in Somerville for a discussion on how structural racism impacts all aspects of life, from housing and education to health and public safety. Just about an hour ago, we caught up with DA Rollins, and I asked her how her office is thinking about the widespread protests calling for major police reform and meaningful action to address systemic racism.
We do need to talk about police reform, but police aren't elected. Mayors are, and they appoint who their commissioners or police chiefs, but district attorneys are elected. And when bad behavior happens, in particular, violent, serious behavior, like we saw with the Derek Chauvin and others. And again, I will not call him Officer Chauvin. It dishonors the word officer. When we look at the Derek Chauvins and the fact that there are many people like him in the past where district attorneys have looked at him or the likes of him and said, I'm not going to prosecute. And that essentially tells whole communities of people, this behavior is okay. There are multiple systems that are allowing it to occur in a police department that doesn't immediately terminate those individuals that are committing crimes. And again, let's be clear, Chris, every profession, forget about police, every profession has bad actors in it. But when we look at a Derek Chauvin and he has 17 infractions, Chris, if you and I worked at Market Basket together, like bagging groceries or as a cashier, and we were got in trouble three or four times, we would lose our job. What is it about the police that we allow bad actors to continue behaving badly? And A, nobody says anything about it, and B, management doesn't terminate them, and C, DAs don't go in and say, I want to look at these internal affairs or anti-corruption investigations and see if we can root out these individuals that are behaving badly or even criminally.
So I want to ask you to that point about an incident that I know your office has opened a criminal probe into. There's a former MBTA transit police officer who has reportedly used excessive force on a black man. I know this is an open investigation, so there's only so much you can tell us about it. But can you tell us how your office is approaching this incident?
Sure. And it's just a man, right? You know, it is a man. And had this been irrespective of race, this was a homeless individual who came into contact with a member of the MBTA police. And unfortunately, the police officer chose to issue a false report. The video appears to show something very differently than what that officer who has since resigned is alleging occurred. What I will say, Chris, that I'm proud of is we didn't know about this incident. That homeless man didn't file a complaint. It was the MBTA leadership that self-reported this to the DA's office. That's the type of strong, bold leadership we need in law enforcement. And we are lucky in parts of Suffolk County, we have that. We have to work together in this world. We are law enforcement partners. And if you don't listen to what the community is saying, this change is going to happen without your important voice at the table.
So I do want to ask you about that meeting and those conversations. But before we shift gears to that, you mentioned there's a video of this incident. Sure. The transit police has said they're not releasing the video because the investigation is still ongoing. Do you believe it should be released and will it be released at some point?
That's interesting. We usually don't release information during the course of an investigation, but I will tell you that we are hoping to move swiftly, not just with this, but a lot of our violent, serious crimes. But we are at a little bit of a detriment right now, Chris, because although we were one of a handful of DA's offices in the nation that had a sitting grand jury, things are stalled a little bit right now because of COVID-19. But we're going to try to be as transparent as we can be. But we have to make sure we are dealing with victims, informing their family first before we let the rest of the Commonwealth know what it is that's happened. If the public has copies of the video, if it's leaked in some other way, it won't be from our office until our investigation is complete, and certainly until we have spoken with the victim's family or the victim himself.
So you mentioned that the transit police brought this incident to your office. I am wondering, you talked last time you were on the show a few weeks ago about the silence from a lot of leadership in law enforcement over the killing of George Floyd. One of the few who had stepped forward in the Boston area was Richard Sullivan, the superintendent for the transit police. He had condemned the killing of George Floyd. The Globe is reporting that not only the officer that resigned, but also his supervisor has also been suspended over this incident. Can you confirm that? And does it say anything about deeper culture within law enforcement?
Yeah, I mean, so those are all administrative actions that I commend if that in fact happened. Action, right? And whether whether it's if whether the community agrees with it or not, at least something was done when they themselves, you know, A, there's a few things to be proud about with the T. They reviewed their video. They make sure that things are happening the way they're supposed to. And then they self-report if they see something that's wrong, irrespective of whether they're going to get a negative result from the community or a positive result. They do what's right, irrespective of the outcome. So that's number one. You know, what I like to see is that there is management that is making sure that they remind their employees of every government sector, not just the police. I know we're harping on them a lot because of the Derek Chauvins of the world, but even in my office, I want to uplift good behavior and I want to correct bad behavior very quickly, but we are held to a different standard because we're the government. And Chris, the police are the only branch of our government that have the lethal and legal authority to kill you without any oversight in that moment, right? And many times, I need to be clear about this, there are really violent and dangerous interactions with law enforcement every day. Not all of them are, certainly. And we what we're talking about now is you can't assume one entire category of people are more dangerous than the other. And that's kind of the tough race conversation we're having. But I'm proud that the T took action. And I'm going to look at this as a result of them bringing it to my attention.
You mentioned the incredible power authority police have. A week ago, there were protesters outside your office asking you to reopen the cases of Terrence Coleman and Usama Rahim, two men who were killed at the hands of police in Boston. You've said that you are committed to discussing these cases with members of your discharge integrity team. Is there any update on that? And how do you plan to pursue those going forward?
I have no problem having discussions about that with my discharge integrity team. Law enforcement, for some reason, and that includes me, we think that we are the only sector in the world that has a 0% error rate, which is it's ridiculous, right? Everyone else knows that, you know, you make a mistake every once in a while. And so we have to always be looking forward while always taking a look back to see did we get it right. And if we got it right, then we got it right. And if we didn't, we're going to make sure we get it right this time.
Okay. I do want to move on and make sure we discuss that. You mentioned you're going to have ongoing conversations. You had one last week with law enforcement executives from around Greater Boston to talk about a lot of these issues. How did that go? And what's the role of those conversations in moving forward?
A lot of progressive prosecutors are at odds, not always, but are at odds with their law enforcement partners because some of our positions aren't consistent with our predecessors. Many conservative district attorneys have not made statements at all about the murders of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, Tony McDade, David McAtee, and so on and so on and so on. And so, you know, they're not meeting with their law enforcement partners because they see nothing wrong with what's happening and think this is just a wave. We don't operate that way in Suffolk County. We have leaders here in management with Commissioner Gross, who openly stated himself that what Derek Chauvin did was disgraceful, with, you know, Chief Guido in Revere, who made a statement as well and put it up on the Revere Police Department website. We have real bold leadership in Suffolk County, but we also have, you know, we don't agree on everything. So we had a closed door, very honest and at times emotional and raw discussion about statements I have made, circumstances we find ourselves in. And I promise you, I actively listened, and so did they. And the meeting that was supposed to be an hour went almost 2 hours. I almost had to pry these men away. And we are committed to meeting again and talking, and then hopefully having other people come into our conversation, right? We need to get our house in order and have respect for each other and our positions. And it was just of the seven of us, it was only six that day because Commissioner Gross was meeting actually with the Attorney General of the United States the same day we met. But it was an incredibly powerful and really productive discussion, but just the beginning, Chris, just the beginning.
Yeah. So you mentioned that sometimes you are at odds with some folks in the law enforcement community. I want to ask you about a social media exchange earlier this month that you had with the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association. We don't have to get into the whole back and forth, but basically they said your comments were anti-police and you clarified these are anti-police brutality comments. Have you spoken with the union and do you have any plans to in the future?
Yeah. So for me, I guess my point was the commissioner immediately made a statement, open and bold. And I'm also a member of NOBLE, the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Officers. We issued a statement as well right away. And what I said to the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association is, hey, guys, and it is overwhelmingly guys, Ben and Jerry's has made a statement about the murder of George Floyd and Black Lives Matter, right? Zappos, who deals with shoes, has made a statement about the murder of George Floyd and Black Lives Matter. McDonald's, right, has made a statement. And last I checked, they aren't in law enforcement, right? And my point was, Chris, is Commissioner Gross is management. Commissioner Gross is not the one. I live in Roxbury. He doesn't work in B2. He's not the one patrolling Humboldt Ave and all the streets throughout Dorchester, Roxbury, and Mattapan, and coming into contact with our most policed and prosecuted communities. That's not him. It's the men and women, the rank and file, that come into contact with the community. And I don't understand what is so hard to ask them just to say, we denounce what Derek Chauvin did, and we stand with our community. And their heels are so dug deep in the ground right now that, you know, to me, I'm busy trying to change the criminal legal system. That's all I'm saying, is our community deserves to know how the police feel about the time we find ourselves in. And you can't hide behind management.
You mentioned the meeting with Commissioner Gross and Attorney General Barr. There's been mixed reactions to that from different folks. Michelle Wu said that Commissioner Gross should never have met with this attorney general because of some of the federal immigration policies and other policies. What did you make of that meeting? Was that a conversation that needed to happen?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We would have loved to have Commissioner Gross at our meeting, but I also think it was good because, you know, the Boston Police Department is one of the largest police departments, or the largest police department in our Commonwealth, obviously. It's the first police department in the United States of America. He's a big figure, literally and figuratively, and I mean that nicely, in the room. And this was an opportunity for me to talk to my other chiefs and colonels and show them love from Suffolk County as far as appreciating what it is that they're going through, the hurt that their staff has, the low morale. And it is a difficult time to be a police officer in this moment. And I think it is callous and not fair for people to say, who cares, right? You know, the Boston is not Minneapolis. I will say every city needs to know, though, they're one incident away from being a Ferguson or being a Minneapolis, but we need to work together and start having tough conversations. Look, Christopher, I have gone to the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association and talked to them for over an hour and a half, took every question, never broke a sweat. I'm the person that calls into Howie Carr and Jeff Cooner. There is nothing I like more than speaking to people that we are not on the same side, because I think they make me better. And I hope I open their eyes to some different perspectives. That is how we're going to change things. But honestly, everyone's entitled to their opinion about what the commissioner did. You know, as somebody who the Attorney General of the United States has personally said, he thinks that I'm, you know, ruining the world by my policies. I will remind the Attorney General, though, that when COVID-19 hit, my list of 15 crimes that in the first instance we don't prosecute, every police department in the nation used my list of 15. None of them were arresting for low-level nonviolent crimes out of fear of contracting COVID-19. What they did was either not arrest or issue a summons. And that's exactly what I said we should do. It just took a global pandemic for people to recognize that I was right. No, I'm joking. But that, you know, that I was thinking about this, right? Number one. And number two, Christopher, in all seriousness, George Floyd would still be alive today if my list of 15 were in. Because what happens is poor communities, Black and brown communities, have too many interactions with the police, period. And many of them are nonviolent and non-serious, and they can escalate in an instant, like we saw with George Floyd, right? He was tried, convicted, sentenced, and executed in 8 minutes and 46 seconds. And the police don't have the power to do that. There are too many other partners in the criminal legal system that have to have a say. And Derek Chauvin made all of those decisions in that 8 minutes and 46 seconds. And by the way, that was for a counterfeit $20 bill. So George Floyd's life wasn't even worth $20. And that is a misdemeanor. If Derek Chauvin had showed up and issued a summons or a ticket to George Floyd, he would still be alive today. But because we are asking the police to do too much, we have too many interactions that escalate with the potential of harm to police officers and to the community.
You mentioned your list of do not prosecute. There was some pushback from police unions over that policy. As we've had conversations over the last few weeks about police reform and looking at some of the protests going on, one of the things we've heard consistently from activists is that police unions have too much power. Do you feel that that's true? And is that something that needs to be addressed?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're seeing is, as I said earlier, police are being asked to do too much, right? And so for me, when I look at the fact that police unions are being asked to deal with treatment, right? Substance use disorder, social emotional wellness, they're dealing with mental illness in civilians. They didn't go to the academy to deal with that. We need trained professionals to do that work. And my list of 15, where in the first instance, we aren't going to prosecute, we're going to look at the root cause. That is all about that. I think police should be involved when all of the rest of society's opportunities have failed, and it is a violent and serious situation, right? So for me, I look at police unions. I'm the proud daughter of two, you know, union members, right? So I am all for strong unions, but we need to make sure that there's some responsibility when people engage in criminal behavior, right? And so qualified immunity is now being considered. Christopher, we're looking at the fact that we are one of two states in the United States of America that does not require licensure of our police officers. Do you understand that in order to be a barber or an electrician, you need a license, right? And barbers can't kill you. They can give you awful highlights and bad bangs, but they cannot kill you. And electricians could wire something and do that. But you get my point, right? Police actually carry guns and can harm us in the name of their job. And there is no oversight with respect to whether they have complaints against them, whether they have lawsuits filed. And then even think about, Christopher, 1983 claims or excessive force claims. If a $5 million verdict comes back against you as a police officer, you don't have to pay that. It's the city that pays it. And what we need is bold mayors or city managers that say to commissioners or chiefs, that's coming out of your budget, number one, or now with no qualified immunity, officers are going to have to, unfortunately, like lawyers and doctors, either get professional liability insurance or have the fear of their home getting a lien on it or something like that if they engage in egregious and vile criminal behavior.
That's Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins. DA Rollins, love to have you back sometime soon to talk more about some of these reforms and what that would actually look like on the ground. Can we have you back sometime soon?
Absolutely. Anytime you ask, I'll be here.
And we are now officially 2 days into astronomical summer. And I think it's fair to say this year is astronomically different than any of us can remember. And if you're like me, you're ready for a break. But as Massachusetts continues to reopen and we're approaching the July 4th weekend, you might be wondering, how do you travel safely during a pandemic? Joining us now to offer some guidance on that is Dr. Lynn Chen. She's the director of the Travel Medicine Center at Mount Auburn Hospital, president of the International Society of Travel Medicine, and an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Chen, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
And also joining us is Elizabeth Scott, Associate Dean and Professor of Biology at Simmons University. She's also the co-director and founder of the Simmons Center for Hygiene and Health in Home and Community. Professor Scott, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much. Good to be here, Chris.
So I've got lots of questions for these two, but I'd love to hear your questions as well. If you have specific questions about your summer travel or just generally how do you navigate the summer season safely, join the conversation 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dr. Chen, I'll start with you because we had you on back March 11th on Radio Boston, which feels like about 30 years ago at this point. Right. I'm curious what in the months that have played out between then and now, what have we learned about the coronavirus and how it spreads, and how are you thinking about our current situation?
Thank you, Chris. So first of all, let me say that there's still so much to learn about this virus. Back in March, we were thinking about how to respond to it, how to go into shelter in home, how to learn more about the virus. And we were watching the outbreaks playing out in Asia and then in Europe. And as far as travel goes, from January until March, most travelers were asking, should I go or should I stay home? Should I cancel? Should I postpone? And we're kind of in a similar situation now as businesses are reopening and people are going into this reopening of society phase two. And so as far as travel goes, I think a lot of people that I've talked with are thinking about more local travel rather than the long distance travel that people had been considering back in January, February, early March. But again, there's still so much we need to learn about this virus. We know a bit about how the clinical symptoms, how frequently it occurs, some of the basic things we can do to prevent getting exposed or getting infected, but there is still a lot we need to learn.
Yeah, I think there's some interesting stuff there. Folks looking at traveling in a more local way, do you think that's just based on the mode of transportation that you need to use, or what do you think it is about staying close that is comforting some folks?
I think the transportation might have something to do about the plans, but I think also because there are still a lot of unknowns about what distant locations may, certain requirements that distant locations or destinations or countries might have. So staying closer to home is an easier way to manage. And going back to the transportation, if one can drive, if you can drive yourself to a national park a few hours away or a beach an hour away, that's also a bit easier to plan. And also to the understanding about the more local epidemiology, whether cases are increasing, what the businesses are doing. I think there are so many things contributing to that decision to staying closer to home.
Yeah, there's an interesting question that driving to a park a few hours away raises for me and at least one of the callers. Again, it's 1-800-423-8255 if you want to join the conversation. Let's go to Jonathan in Chilmark. Jonathan, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
I wanted to ask the doctors how best to manage restroom stops on the highway. I'm always nervous going into a restroom area and practicing best hygiene for folks.
Yeah, Jonathan, I think it's a great question, and I think it's one a lot of people are thinking about. So let me throw this to both of you guys. What should folks be thinking about using public restrooms?
I can start on this one. I've been thinking about this one, too. This is Liz Scott here. It's very important to, I think, minimize your time in the restroom. So be efficient and get out of there pretty quickly. I would recommend sanitizing your hands on the way in as well as on the way out. That way you don't actually add any contamination yourself to the environment. Wear a mask, do a thorough 20-second hand wash, and use a paper towel preferably to dry your hands, and then use a paper towel to actually exit the facility and sanitize your hands on the way out. I'd also say that restrooms are not the place to be using cell phones and hanging out anymore. So, you know, I think being efficient and getting out of there is the thing to do.
Get going and then get going. Got that. Yeah. So I'm curious, are you like the air dryers?
Completely.
Yeah. The air dryers, how risky are those? Is that, would you rather see people walk out with wet hands if that's the only option?
No. You know, I think Americans understand thoroughly hand washing now, but what we haven't taught, or we don't hear so much in the conversation, is the importance of hand drying. That's the second part of the process. So it is really important to dry your hands. So preferably, just because we're really not sure about the potential effect of blowing things around in restrooms using these hand dryers. Preferably I would use paper towels if possible, but if not, go to the hand dryer.
Yeah. Professor Scott, obviously hygiene is your area of expertise. You specialize in this. Is there anything you think besides the hand drying that is missing from our conversation about hygiene or the way we think about and approach hygiene?
In restrooms? Are we talking about specifically?
Or generally, as we're navigating, things are reopening. Yeah.
Yeah. I think what's really important is that we have to, I've sort of been thinking about this today and thinking about, we just have to be so mindful about hygiene in a way that we haven't been for a very, very long time. I mean, decades and decades. We've really become quite complacent. And so right now, there's no room for complacency. And so with regard to this question of traveling, I think, you know, I've broken it down into sort of thinking, prioritizing your plans to minimize your risk. And maybe that's why people are choosing not to fly, because for them, that's not the most important priority right now. Taking personal responsibility to protect yourself and to protect others. That's really high on my list. You know, we don't just receive hygiene, we have to practice hygiene, and we practice it to protect ourselves and to protect people around us. And then
it's a really interesting risk benefit analysis that we're kind of all going through at this point.
Yep, exactly. And then I think, you know, you've already mentioned the importance of planning, and I think it's possible to do this as safely as possible by really planning and breaking down the travel into small steps and thinking about each part of the journey and how to accomplish it safely. And paramount all the time is you know, physical or social distancing and wearing a mask.
Yeah. Dr. Chen, you talked at the beginning about some of the benefits of traveling in a more local way. I do want to go to the phones here. We've got an interesting question from Yolette in Randolph. Yolette, welcome to Radio Boston. What's on your mind?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I, in fact, see Dr. Chen almost every summer before I travel to Haiti for my volunteering work. And so my question to her is, does she feel that it's safe to travel to a country like Haiti this summer?
It's a great question, Yolette. Dr. Chen, what do you say?
Hi, it's so nice to hear from you. Thanks for that question. So traveling abroad this summer is quite complicated. And so I think to start, we want to think about whether you have any increased risk when it comes to COVID, in terms of getting severe disease or the fatal disease, critical disease. There are a number of health problems older age is a concern. Cardiovascular disease, diabetes, hypertension, respiratory disease, underlying respiratory disease, those are all potentially can increase a traveler's risk for severe disease from COVID. So think about that and then consider whether you would tolerate certain is coming down with COVID and whether you would accept coming down with a disease like COVID in a foreign country or in another country. And I'm aware that you go to Haiti regularly and doing great work. But think about how you comfortable you would feel if you were to get sick. And so basically it's your threshold for the risk and your risk tolerance. And how important is it to travel at this time versus postponing it a bit until the situation with COVID is a bit clearer. And then
To interrupt you, Dr. Chen, but I just want to follow right there with the situation a bit clearer. Does that mean until we have a vaccine, until we have effective treatment? What's the finish line look like?
Exactly. So until we have an effective vaccine and treatment, an antiviral that will really take care of COVID. So let's just assume that you are thinking that you are going to go, then think about the transport itself, the how you get to the airport, ground transport. Do you feel safe about that one? The airplane itself, I think many airlines have introduced improved disinfection, social distancing, physical distancing in terms of seating, wearing face covering, face mask, good hand sanitizing, wiping down, disinfecting places that you touch, trying to avoid touching your face, trying to avoid touching high traffic areas, high touch areas when you're in the airports, waiting areas, and places like that. And think about where you might be staying when you arrive there, and whether they may be taking measures to reduce the chances of transmission of COVID. So there are many, many concerns, many more questions that we assess now with COVID. And then as far as activities go, we also have to think about whether you're doing outdoor versus indoor activities when you're there, whether you're going to be with large crowds, whether you might be among people who may be carrying it but are not aware because they're not getting tested due to the local health system and what their capacity is at your destination in terms of testing and health service for foreigners. So there are many more questions that we consider
just
now.
Just a few things to be thinking about, huh? I want to get a couple more callers in while we've got a few minutes here. Chrissy in Quincy, you're up next. Welcome to the show. Chrissy, what's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because my family and I, my sister and I, and sometimes my daughter, we like to go to the Hydrangea Festival down in the Cape. And we like to drive together, but we are not in the same household. I'm wondering if that's, something we should be doing, or do we need to take separate cars to make the trip?
That's a great question, Chrissy. And I'd love to add to that, too. Dr. Chen mentioned, think about where you're staying. Let me throw this one to you, Professor Scott, in terms of both driving, should they drive in separate cars, but also if you're staying at a hotel or a rental property, what should you be thinking about on that end as well?
Sure, great question, Chrissy. And really, you're kind of talking about expanding your bubble. It sounds like you're living in one bubble with your family, and now you want to expand your bubble to your sister. And so, there are a lot of questions to think about that. I think, obviously, the straightforward answer is if you can drive separately, then that would be the safest thing to do. Otherwise, you really have to think about each party who wants to get together in the bubble. You have to think about spending time isolating yourselves before you get together so that you can get together and actually even possibly testing. That would be ideal if possible before you get together. And I know other people are thinking about getting together with other family members. And at this time of year, people are often thinking about getting together, bringing the kids up to see the grandparents. So, you know, another question is, who's at risk in your bubble? You know, is there anyone that you'd get together with who's at greater risk than you for complications of COVID because of their age or because of other underlying conditions? And then, Chris, you asked about where you stay, rentals and hotels. So, you know, there
are let's say that group, that expanded bubble, is staying together in an Airbnb or something. Is that a feasible situation? How would you navigate that?
There are questions to ask if you're renting or going into a hotel. Things like asking the place you're going to, who was last there, or when were people last there? Many Airbnbs are talking about a 3-day buffer now between rentals, so to give time, because we know that the virus potentially can survive for up to 72 hours on inanimate surfaces. And I think that's, you know, that to give 3 days is a very safe period of time between rentals. So, you know, what's the buffer since anyone was last there? How is the place being cleaned and disinfected? These are things you want to know about. And then when you get there, you want to think, well, or before you get there, is there room there to safely quarantine someone if they were in your family bubble, if they were to go down with symptoms? Can you separate them out? So those are, you know, important things to think about before you even get there. And then there are some things you can do when you actually arrive on site. You know, you want to wear a mask when you arrive. I would recommend opening up all the doors and windows so that you have good airflow through the indoor environment. And then everybody who's in that bubble, in that space now, you become one family unit in that bubble, and you have to make some commitment to each other that you're going to now keep the bubble closed. So, you know, if you're with grandparents, even if the grandparents stay at the base, at the Airbnb base, but other members of the family go off to some other event or to restaurants or bars, you are in effect bringing all those people you met, you're in effect bringing them back to your grandparents when you get back. So, you know, there has to be some mutual understanding and commitment as to what that time together is really going to look like.
Dr. Chen, final question. We just got about 20 seconds or so. Max in Weston was wondering, does it make sense to try to plan to travel to places with lower number of COVID cases?
I think that is a good consideration. If you're thinking about going to another state, for example, that has lower COVID transmission, or another location, another country. But remember that different places have different requirements. So
it's all about the testing numbers, I'm sure.
It's all about testing, right? So you might need to be tested. You might need to go into quarantine.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That's Dr. Lin Chen, Director of the Travel Medicine Center at Mount Auburn Hospital, President of the International Society of Travel Medicine, and Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School, and Elizabeth Scott, Associate Dean and Professor of Biology at Simmons University. Thank you both so much. Really appreciate the time today.